Today in Studio 360, the director Robert Rodriguez has been making successful movies since he started the Spy Kids franchise, From Dusk Till Dawn, Once Upon a Time in Mexico.
Are you a Mexican or a Mexicant?
I'm a Mexican.
Compared to that, starting a cable TV channel sounds like maybe not as much fun. Why do it?
I have five children who, even though they are bilingual, they really live their lives in English, and they really don't have anything on television that really represents who they are in this country.
Film auteur turned TV mogul Robert Rodriguez. Plus, a live performance from On the Rise rockers The War on Drugs.
I just thought The War on Drugs was, with the in there obviously is important too, but I just thought that was like the coolest band name you could have.
I'm Kurt Anderson. That and much more is ahead in this hour of Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Right after this.
Studio 360 is supported by Lumosity.com, a brain training program designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 50 million people worldwide. More at Lumosity.com. And by Delta Airlines, offering a USB port at every seat on all long-haul international flights. Delta. Keep climbing.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. March Madness is here. And as the host of a public radio show about the arts, that means absolutely nothing to me. Except this year, KPCC in Los Angeles has made a public radio March Madness bracket. Instead of college basketball teams going head-to-head, it's all your favorite public radio shows facing off for bragging rights. We've made it to round two, but we need your help to take down the Brian Lehrer Show. Your vote for Studio 360 is a vote for the arts, a vote for culture, a vote for civilization. All the details are at Studio360.org.
Anderson with a steal. Uh-oh.
Showtime! 360.
I can't believe it! Oh, that's awesome! He's a 3S man! He's super! He's sensational! He's superb!
Hey, Cap, how do we know the good guys from the bad guys? If they're shooting at you, they're bad.
Superhero movies, the ones based on comic books, are now their own hugely lucrative and dominant Hollywood genre.
Hey, Cap, found those bad guys you were talking about.
You okay?
I'm not dead yet.
Last year, Iron Man 3, the Superman movie, and Thor were all among the biggest box office hits. This year, just for starters, there'll be Captain America, Spider-Man, X-Men. But why no movies about a female superhero? Like, say, Wonder Woman. Fans have waited for years for her own movie, but in the next Superman sequel, she's just got a supporting role. There's been lots of recent talk about a Black Widow movie starring Scarlett Johansson.
Stay in the car.
I'm not staying in the car.
You want to help? Keep the car running.
Okay.
Hey, you can't come here like this.
But just last week, the head of Marvel Studios made it clear that's not happening. To try to figure out this particular boys' club, I am joined by Ann Thompson, the veteran entertainment journalist who has a blog called Thompson on Hollywood and a new book called The $11 Billion Year. Ann, welcome back to Studio 360.
Happy to be here.
So what gives? We first thought we were getting this Wonder Woman movie, and then we thought we were getting this Black Widow movie, and now we're getting Bupkis.
Well, the studios are really gun-shy on this. Catwoman didn't work out, and neither did Jennifer Garner when she did Elektra. It's really a question of women not being able to get away with failure, and the men just don't have confidence. James Cameron and Ridley Scott figured out with Alien, with Sigourney Weaver,
right,
that she could save the world.
No, and we thought that seemed at the time even to be, okay, this is the beginning of this new action movie starring women era.
It didn't happen. Women have tried, and they don't get many opportunities at bat. And I will argue that someone like Sandra Bullock in Gravity as an action hero, she's going to make $70 million. But that was a very big aberration from the norm.
She personally will make $70 million from Gravity, and by the way, a movie that more men than women went to.
Correct.
So the Hunger Games franchise, in which Jennifer Lawrence stars, the latest one, Catching Fire, was the most successful movie at the box office last year, ahead of Iron Man 3, starring a man. And as you mentioned, Gravity, which has made over $500 million around the world. Shouldn't this be the inflection point where the people running studios go, yeah, okay, movies starring women in these superheroic roles obviously work?
Well, there's Divergent coming up with another young woman, and hopefully she can carry it, Shailene Woodley. The question is why women are allowed to behave in certain ways, so that in Hunger Games, she's doing everything in order to save her family.
Uh-huh.
Somehow that's justified. And, you know, in the case of Gravity, Sandra Bullock is really trying to save herself. And they make George Clooney the more expert guy. She's a neophyte. I mean, there are careful ways that women are allowed to be a certain way.
Well, and as you think about it, beyond the issues of sexism, which we'll talk about, is it harder to think of how a superhero, an Iron Man, a Thor, a Superman kind of conventional superhero could be written and performed successfully by a woman? Are there something about those roles?
Yes. I mean, Marvel has done it better than DC, but part of the trick of taking these comic book heroes is placing them in a believably real world when many of them were created decades ago.
As you say, Marvel, certainly in the comic books, are known for their diversity, sexually, racially, ethnically, gender preferentially, every other way, and they have four superhero movies coming out this year. Are they somehow unable to transfer that, oh, we can do it differently, we're Marvel, from the comic book format to the movie format?
Apparently, but this is where I get mad. I mean, the women are 51% of the population, and Hollywood continues to act as if they're a niche.
Yeah.
You know, some small group that needs to be given a handout every now and then. The statistics are so clear that movies aimed at women do really well, like Hunger Games. And over the past 30 years, there's been no noticeable progress, really. You know, behind the camera, in terms of the amount of roles that are given to women that come out in a given year. And the Hollywood system is so biased toward action that women just don't get a chance to get a foothold. Angelina Jolie is the great exception.
And she made the two Lara Croft movies a decade ago. Did that not help the idea that, okay, women can do these kinds of things?
It's almost like Angelina Jolie is, again, the exception. You know, and it was an interesting thing in Gravity. Sandra Bullock was allowed to not be sexy in a weird way. There was careful calibration there. And she was allowed to be an authority figure who was good at her job, vulnerable. So the question is, how do you take Wonder Woman, who's a very sexy creature, and make her able to carry a heroic movie? And I think that's what throws everybody off.
So what is your best expert opinion bet? Are we coming to a moment of change at the beginning of the end of this men-only movie superhero age? In 5 or 10 years, will there be a bunch of women, or not so fast?
I think there's a lot of consciousness raising going on, and I think that people are trying. It's going to take a while. And I thought by now it would have gotten a lot farther than it has.
Yeah.
It's pretty sad.
Anne, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Anne Thompson runs the blog Thompson on Hollywood. Her new book is called The $11 Billion Year. So what do you think? Is it important to have more female superhero movies, or would you rather see more women starring in other kinds of films? Tell us in a comment at studio360.org. Robert Rodriguez made his name in 1992 with his first film, a very, very low-budget action movie called El Mariachi. He went on to make commercial hits, including the Spy Kids movies, but never really totally went Hollywood. He built his own studio in Austin and continued making cult films like Sin City and Once Upon a Time in Mexico, which brought back the guitar-wielding gunfighter from his first movie.
He was a legend. They used to say he was the biggest Mexican they'd ever seen. He was 5'9", 5'10", tops. It's no record, but bigger than most of us. They called him Mariachi because he used to carry this guitar.
A guitar?
Believe me, he really knew how to play it, too.
Robert Rodriguez's latest project is a departure from that kind of one-off personalized movie making. He is creating and running the new cable TV channel El Rey, which just launched. Robert Rodriguez, welcome to Studio 360.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. So the El Rey network, which means, I guess, the king?
Yeah.
In Spanish. Explain what it is and why and how it came to be.
There was I was always interested in doing television. Even from the very beginning, Hollywood would call me in to see if I had television ideas because I thought, here's a guy who can work really fast and really cheap. but I didn't care so much for the process. You know, it's very different from films. I had a lot more control in the film world. Right. And television seemed like you were really out of your hands. And there was a moment in time where this became possible, where Comcast and Universal were going to be merging, and the FCC would only allow it if they designate a certain amount of channels to independent owner and operators, four of which had to be minority owned.
Huh.
So Magic Johnson put in a bid for one. Sean Combs put an idea for one, and I put an idea for this general entertainment, total audience, Hispanic, English language network.
Although now you have to be that executive who goes, no, can you make him more likable? I mean, don't you now have to be that jerk?
Yeah, well, but it'd been coming from a place of being a creative person as well. So when I go to someone like Bob Orsi and I say, Bob, I noticed that you've done 3 pilots in the past couple of years, only one of which has gotten to air.
And he's the great writer of Star Trek movies and Transformers movies and other
Sleepy things. Hollow, which was his 3rd pilot in a row. The other two didn't go. So I went to him. He told me his idea for sort of a Latin, you know, secret agent who's soccer player by day and secret agent by night, because that's his cover. I say, there's no pilot. You're actually going to get 13 episodes, guaranteed prime time, this amount of money per episode, and we start now.
So it's Latin influenced, but all in English?
All in English. You know, the reason I think I even attempted it was when I heard about the opportunity. I thought, oh, I've got to do that. You know, I have 5 children who, even though they are bilingual, they really live their lives in English, and they really don't have anything on television that really represents who they are in this country. And I know that that's the case for most English language Hispanics.
So what, I mean, will it be FX-ish? Will it be AMC-ish? Will it be if Miramax had a channel?
It's going to be, when you already look at our programming, Quentin called me the other day. He didn't know he even had it on the air and on his house. And he called me and said, man, I was looking for something to watch and I was for taping and I saw someone was playing Starsky and Hutch. And I was like, wow, I haven't seen that show in so long. Who's playing Starsky and Hutch? And it was your network. Huh. And then tonight you're playing my 2 favorite Kung Fu movies, Avenging Eagle and Chinese Boxer. I said, yeah, we're on the air now. We're going to be curating all the content that goes on, stuff that I'm genuinely a fan of is going to be on the network. Cult films, you know, Kung Fu, martial arts, Grindhouse, to fill out the schedule, classic television shows that I was a big fan of, like X-Files and Jim Cameron's Dark Angel and Starsky and Hutch for right now.
One of the shows, and the only one I've seen so far, is From Dusk Till Dawn. That movie came out 18 almost years ago. Have you always thought, nah, that'd make a great TV show? Or did you just say suddenly, oh, I've got a schedule to fill and this might work?
When I thought about what kind of shows can I put on that nobody else would be able to, people had asked to make that into a show before, and Quentin and I controlled the rights to it. We didn't really, even if somebody had the right intentions, if they take it to a network, the network, who knows what they would make them end up doing with it. So I'd rather just to leave it alone. But when it's our own network, then we could do it correctly and give it the kind of creative freedom that it needs. And I had always had that matte painting from the end of Dusk Till Dawn, the film, on my wall. I used to stare at it and go, wow, that was a pretty cool idea. I tried to fit into that script, but it didn't fit into the script. The whole mythology, this Mayan, Aztec, pre-Christianity idea of heaven and hell. But I left some hints in the actual film, like that last shot where the bar is actually built on top of a pyramid and you wonder, you know, what could be inside.
Let's play a clip from Dusk Till Dawn.
Could I get you something to drink?
No, I got it.
It's funny. All these drinks have funny names. Beast, Demon Drink, Lizard Water. Whatever happened to the simple days? You know, RC Cola was a fancy name back in my day, you know? Do you remember that drink, Jolt? That was a great drink. Wish they still made that.
I'm only 21.
What's your name?
Jesse.
Like Jesse James?
I don't know. Does she spell with an I-E? Tell you what I'd like to drink.
You.
Well, how the hell she spell it?
That was Callie Hernandez and Zane Holtz in Robert Rodriguez's new series From Dusk Till Dawn on the El Rey channel, based on his film. The guy we hear there is playing a bad guy, a really bad guy. If these guys are the main character of the show, I guess it's a real measure of where we are in cable TV drama these days, that such dark dudes can carry a show.
Yeah, they're very complex characters, and the way we write them in this series is really there's a twist in it from what you saw in the film. We get to dive a lot deeper into these criminal masterminds and really challenge the audience. I mean, they start off as really bad guys, and you become extremely likable pretty quickly, and then you see why they're doing what they're doing, and the causes are a lot more tied to that pyramid than you would think, you know, than in the film.
The movie took place from dusk till dawn. How do you stretch out a night to many seasons? I mean, the first episode was more or less in real time, an hour, more or less.
Yeah, pretty much real time. There's some flashbacks to events that happened before that help fill that time and give you a lot more color into things, events that maybe were only mentioned in the film that you now see fully formed. That was the whole thing about the series. I told Quentin about early on, he thought it was a great idea, was to take the whole season and have it take place from dusk till dawn.
And then you've got to figure out your second season.
Second season we've been thinking about, and I'm actually ever in the writing room talking about things that happen as far off as fifth season.
Really?
So you certainly can plan pretty far in advance when you get into an idea this rich.
So this year you are coming out with a film in addition to creating a channel, a sequel to your film Sin City that came out in 2005. These movies are co-directed by you and the comic book artist Frank Miller. How does – you're not brothers. Most of the people who co-direct are brothers. How does that work?
How does it work? It's the most fun you can have is having another director on the set, another brain, another pair of eyes, another decision maker. But also because he created that world. I mean, he's the only one who's been to Sin City. So I really wanted to have him there to really be authentic to what he wrote and drew. So he's already directed it. He directed it with paper and a pen.
I want to play a clip from the original Sin City to give people a sense of the comic book noir world it is.
I don't know why you died, Goldie. I don't know why, and I don't know how. I never even met you before tonight. But you were a friend and more when I needed one. And when I find out who did it, it won't be quick and quiet like it was with you. It'll be loud and nasty. My kind of kill. And when his eyes go dead, the hell I send him to will seem like heaven after what I've done to him.
That was Mickey Rourke from Sin City. Looking at all your films, including Sin City, you seem to like stories about protagonists who are almost indestructible, which gets me to thinking that you've been making movies about crypto superheroes all this time.
Yeah, they're all pretty mythical and iconic and...
And don't die.
They don't. They go on forever. Even the Spy Kids were like that. They were invincible. Those guys. No, they all have their weaknesses, and they all need their Achilles heel. But they are pretty much larger than life. I don't think I'd ever done anything that's not fantastical.
And if you were, if you took one of those quizzes to say which superhero are you, it seems to me like you're the Batman of show business. Is that right?
Probably more the Joker.
Really? Uh oh.
I don't know who I would be. That's a good question.
Well, you can think on that.
Yeah.
Robert Rodriguez, thank you very much. This was a pleasure.
Thanks so much.
From Dusk Till Dawn, the series has just premiered on the El Rey channel.
Inspector Gadget.
There you go. Inspector Gadget. I love that idea. Coming up, an event that might seem like an historical footnote, but China's Boxer Rebellion is a story as strange and tragic as anything in fiction.
It was like this ragtag army of these poor, illiterate teenagers from the Chinese farmlands who believed that they could call the Chinese gods down from the skies, and these Chinese gods would give them superpowers.
The comic book virtuoso Gene Luen Yang tells the story of the Boxer Rebellion in a graphic novel. That's next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Lumosity.com, a brain training program designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 50 million people worldwide. More at Lumosity.com. And by Delta Airlines, offering a USB port at every seat on all long-haul international flights. Delta, keep climbing.
This is Kurt Anderson, and you're listening to Studio 360. The Boxer Rebellion is one of those events you're supposed to know about. Maybe you once did, but I'm willing to bet you don't. And that's okay, because the comic book artist and author Gene Luen Yang presents the conflict in a terrific illustrated novel that was a finalist for last year's National Book Award. In the year 1900, Chinese peasants were fed up with the Western business people and Christian missionaries in their country. The insurgency of the Boxers, as they were called, was quickly crushed by international armed forces, but not before they killed more than 30,000 Chinese Christian converts.
It was like this ragtag army of these poor, illiterate teenagers from the Chinese farmlands who believed that they could call the Chinese gods down from the skies, and these Chinese gods would give them superpowers.
Talk about the characters you chose to represent each side.
Both of the protagonists are fictional. So the main character in the first volume is a boy named Little Bao, who grows up to become a boxer. On the other side, the main character is a young woman named Four Girl. She's born into a Chinese family, a traditional Chinese family that doesn't really accept her. And she grows up to convert to Catholicism.
And you were raised as a Christian and are still a practicing Christian, yeah?
Yeah, I'm still a practicing Catholic, yeah.
And given that you had a home team, did that make it hard to depict the boxer side even-handedly?
Well, I think like a lot of Asian American Christians, I think I grew up within this tension between Western belief systems and Eastern culture. So it very much I feel like this book, the dual nature of this book sort of expresses an ambivalence I have about my own identity.
Your scenes in which the peasants turn into warrior gods are especially dramatic. The frames get suddenly large, the colors are intense, and the faces are kind of terrifying. The book became more comic bookish at those moments and less sort of graphic novel.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a huge comic book fan. I grew up reading comic books. I grew up reading superhero comic books. And that was one of the ways I found a connection with these boxers, with these teenagers from over 100 years ago. These young men, they first learned about the heroes of Chinese mythology through Chinese opera. So China has this long tradition of opera. And it's very colorful, it's very dramatic and very stylistic. And when I read about Chinese opera, and especially when I read about Chinese opera's place in these young men's lives, I saw a lot of connections between Chinese opera and American superhero comics.
Huh.
You know, both of these media, they tell stories about these heroes who dress in bright colors, who have superpowers, who fight these epic battles for the fate of the world. And in a lot of ways, you know, how the way American geeks latch on to superheroes is sort of the way these young men in China latched on to Chinese opera. They felt hopeless and angry, and they expressed their hopelessness and anger. They dealt with their hopelessness and anger by identifying strongly with these heroes that they watched on stage.
Well, and comic book superheroes are often mostly sort of navigating between two worlds.
Yeah, that's something that my Asian American comic book friends and I talk about a lot. There are a lot of Asian Americans involved in comics right now in every level of the medium. And we wonder if in a lot of ways we're attracted to this medium because we grew up with these stories of American superheroes. And every American superhero negotiates between multiple identities, right? So Batman isn't just Batman. He's also Bruce Wayne. So in a lot of ways, I think Asian Americans and immigrants' kids in general, we can find reflections of ourselves in these characters.
Yeah. You've written other stories about the tensions between East and West and immigrants. American-born Chinese is about a kid growing up in a San Francisco suburb, one of the only Asian kids in his school. You grew up in a San Francisco suburb, one of the only Asian kids in your schools. Am I wrong to imagine that American-born Chinese is wholly autobiographical?
It's not wholly autobiographical. It's fiction, but I did pull heavily from my own life in order to create that book. When my family first moved into the neighborhood where I spent most of my childhood, we were one of just a handful of Chinese American families there. There were so few of us that my mom actually went to the school and asked them for the addresses of the other Chinese American families. And then we went and made house calls one afternoon. We just went and met all three or four of them. Nowadays, it would be seen as something crazy, right? You wouldn't do that at all. But back then, because there were so few of us, that was an accepted thing to do.
American-born Chinese takes a kind of surreal turn when it becomes, for a while, a sitcom. And the comic relief is this character called Chin Ki, who's a caricature with buck teeth and very yellow skin. And he speaks with this extreme stereotypical accent. And he's supposed to be embarrassing. That is the point, which is part of what makes the book great. But did people at the time think, oh, my God, he's stepped over some kind of – line of taste? Were you like, was it like Portnoy's complaint among Chinese Americans?
That was definitely Chinky. Cousin Chinky was by far the most controversial part of American born.
So I didn't even want to say Chinky because that sounded more racist.
Yeah. I did that on purpose. I get three different kinds of reactions to Cousin Chinky. You know, usually from older Asian Americans in their 50s and 60s, a lot of them will get to the point in the book where Chinky shows up and they'll tell me that character made them feel so uncomfortable that they had a hard time finishing the book from that point on. And in a lot of ways, I feel good about that because I feel like that was kind of what I was going for. Then from other folks, other readers, usually Asian Americans who are around my age or younger, a lot of them will tell me that they found Cousin Chinky really funny. They found him really hilarious, but they felt guilty about laughing and they felt really it was like they were laughing with a knot in their stomach.
Yeah.
And I kind of feel like that's good too because that's kind of what I was going for as well. And then the minority opinion, the minority reaction that I get, every now and then somebody will come up to me and tell me, oh, you know that Cousin Chinky character? He's so cute. Have you ever thought about making him into like a plush doll or putting him on a t-shirt?
Oof.
And those folks,
yeah.
That makes me feel uncomfortable, you know, because that was not what I was going for at all.
That pickaninny commodification idea?
Yeah. My only regret for American-born Chinese is that I didn't exaggerate Cousin Chinky even more. Because I feel like if I had made him look even more monstrous, if I had made him look even more brightly yellow and more, you know, more exaggerated, maybe that final reaction would go away.
Yeah. Well, when you're not writing about crises in cultural identity, you're also writing the Avatar, The Last Airbender comic book series. And I want to point out that that's different from the pretty terrible movie version from a few years ago. How did you get The Last Airbender gig?
That was an amazing thing that happened. I was a huge fan of that show. So Avatar The Last Airbender, to my mind, it was probably the best American-produced animation show ever.
Uh-huh.
I mean, the writing in that show was just stellar. It was meant for kids 7 and up, but they dealt with all sorts of really complex topics like, you know, culture and the nature of evil, all sorts of things, family dynamics. Well, after the show ended, they announced that they're going to make a live-action movie based on the show, and I was really excited about that. Then they announced that M. Night Shyamalan was going to direct it, and I was a little bit less excited. I thought, well, you know, I liked his first two or three movies.
Yep.
And then they announced the casting, and in the show is set in a fantasy world, but it's a fantasy world based on real-world Asian cultures. You know, it pulls heavily from Japan and from China, from the Inuit cultures. But for when they casted the live action version, they gave all of the major heroic roles to white actors. And to me, it just felt like yet another instance of yellowface, of Hollywood's practice of giving these roles that would most logically go to Asian or Asian American actors and giving them to white actors.
And then when did you start writing the comic?
The way I got the comic gig was I was so mad about this movie that I did a webcomic about how I was never going to see this movie because of this issue. And I put it up on my website. And one of the folks that read that webcomic was an editor at Dark Horse Comics.
Uh-huh.
So a few years later, Dark Horse purchases from Nickelodeon the license to do these Airbender comics. And because this editor had read this comic of mine complaining about the live-action movie, she knew I was a fan. And she contacted me and asked me if I'd be willing to write it for them.
Wow. That's one of the most gratifying acts of revenge in a cultural way I've ever heard. That's great.
Yeah, I was just very excited to dive into this world. I asked her, do we have to reference the movie at all? And she said, no,
yeah,
not at all. So,
you have that great gig. You've won awards. You publish widely. You still work as an administrator at a high school?
I do. Years ago, I was a full-time high school teacher. I taught mostly computer science, but I did some math and some art as well. And a few years ago, I had to go part-time, but it's difficult for me to imagine leaving that community completely or just leaving education completely. I think I'm just as passionate about education as I am about comics.
And does being this big comic book guy and graphic novelist make high school kids think, hey, you know, Mr. Yang, he's cool. He does these things. He's not just a teacher.
Not at all. I think it's just hard to impress teenagers that you see on a daily basis.
Well, yes.
Yeah.
It's hard to impress teenagers, I think, is a given in almost every culture.
Yeah, that's right.
Jean-Luen Yang, thank you so much. It's a pleasure.
Thank you, Kurt. It was great to talk to you.
Jean-Luen Yang is the author of Boxers and Saints. You can see some images from the book at studio360.org. New Year's resolutions can be a setup, a trap, but they're easier to fulfill if you're trying to do something positive, like write a musical, perform stand-up, or play a show with your new band. Three of our listeners are intending to perform just those creative feats this year. And Adrian Ognebean, our fourth 2014 creative resolution maker, is returning to drawing and painting after years away from the easel.
In January, the first thing I did was I bought a bunch of soft fine charcoal because that was always my favorite medium to work with and what I was most comfortable with. And I did a couple really rough sketches and then I sat down to do a full drawing. I found that the stuff I had been doing before in my early 20s, I wasn't that interested in. So I felt kind of lost in terms of what subject matter I wanted to do. So I've kind of gone back to what I remember from art school, still lifes, and there's a self-portrait that I've just started, and things that are very concrete and kind of boring, but hoping that eventually something will more inspire me into a theme. It always looks very flat at this stage because the very last thing I do is put in like whites and blacks and the extreme color changes. The biggest challenge for me starting it was not only the lag in time from regularly painting, but also I had an injury to my hand. My hand got shut in a car door and there was a lovely dent in my arm and everything, and there's some nerve damage. What was interesting about it was it happened a few months right before I was scheduled to start law school anyway. So I had the injury and then I had this really good excuse to not do anything creative because I was in law school. It being March now, I've got two paintings that have actual paint on them. I'd hope to have had a couple more drawings done and be a little farther along than I am. I'm not panicky yet. That'll probably come about September, October. I bought a ton of canvases. I went to the back to school sale at the old art store that I went to when I was in college and bought a ton of canvases and everything. So I'm hoping that now that there's daylight savings times and it's getting warmer, I can go outside some. I have more light when I get home from work and more time to get some more ideas. I used to be very slow and meticulous, and I'm learning I have to be a lot faster because I only have, like, you have an hour today, and then you still have to cook dinner. Another problem is we have a very small apartment, and I do most of my work actually in the kitchen, so everything has to be really portable back and forth so I can also cook in my kitchen, because that's pretty much where we do everything. So you have to move everything away, clean it all up, and make it all go away so you can cook dinner and don't wind up eating your acrylic paint.
Adrian Ognebean listens to Studio 360 in Tacoma Park, Maryland. It's a year-long reality show, so you can track all four of our creative resolution makers at studio360.org. Still ahead in Studio 360, the war on drugs, a rising indie band that is not afraid to wear their influences on their sleeves.
I wasn't into Bob Dylan so much when I was a kid. It wasn't until I was like 23. It's like the first time you go through like your first bad breakup. And then you hear Blood on the Tracks from the same time.
Yeah.
Is when you can kind of like, it's more than just Mr. Tambourine Man.
A performance from the War on Drugs is next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. When I met you, and I fell away again. I'm Kurt Anderson, and this is Studio 360. The war on drugs became a thing and a phrase in the early 1970s, when I was young, when rock and roll was excitingly new. So I guess it makes sense that the band called The War on Drugs, formed less than a decade ago, reminds me of the music and bands of my youth, in the very best ways. This is music you want to put on in your car and drive to, and maybe keep driving all night. Which also makes sense because that's how the founder and lead singer of The War on Drugs, Adam Grandisile, worked out most of the songs on his new album, driving at night alone in his van. That record, Lost in the Dream, is out now, and The War on Drugs, in addition to Mr. Grandisile, David Hartley, Robbie Bennett, and Anthony LaMarca, are here with me now in the studio. Welcome to Studio 360.
Thanks for having us. It's a pleasure.
So, Adam, you're the front man.
Mm-hmm.
You play guitar. You write all the music. So The War on Drugs is a band, but also kind of a solo project, I guess.
I guess so, yeah. I mean, I think what makes it a band, which it definitely is that those two things can exist without me feeling in a strange situation like with everybody else. I mean, everyone in the band is pretty much my favorite player. Like, Dave's the best contemporary bass player. You know what I mean? And he happens also to be my friend and in the band. And Robbie's, like, my favorite piano player and keyboard. And he's, like, in the band.
And the band's name is a good name and maybe better than your name.
That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. And it's kind of ironic, but your music isn't ironic at all, really.
I don't think so, no.
Yeah. It's very – it is what it is.
I mean,
sincere.
In terms of band names, too, nowadays, there's a lot of band names. But back in the day when I, you know, I just thought The War on Drugs was – with the in there, obviously, is important, too. But
yeah.
I just thought that was, like, the coolest band name you could have.
Will you play a song, and then we'll talk some more?
Yeah, we're going to play Eyes to the Wind.
Excellent.
Cool.
Sailing down here on the wind. at you, and I fell away again. And like a train in reverse down a dark road, I'm carrying the whole load, just rattling the whole way. Your eyes to the wind, and pull you in again on the way back in. I'm just a bit run down here at the moment. Let me think about it, babe. Cold wind blowing down my old road, down the back streets where the pines grow, as the river splits the undertow, yeah. But I'd be lying to myself if I said I didn't mind, leave it hanging on the line and lost inside my head. Is this the way I'll be tonight again? So I set my eyes on the one, but it won't be easy. It ain't that hard. I just arrived down here on the scene, and there's a stranger living in me. Your eyes to the wind, and you see me pull away again, having lost it on a friend. I'm just a bit run down here at the moment, and I'm all alone here, living in darkness.
That was The War on Drugs playing Eyes to the Wind off their new album, Lost in the Dream. Now, Adam, I mention, and people often mention, Bob Dylan, and you You have said he was your guy early on. One hears him in that song, certainly. Is that okay? I'm going to sort of emphasize my Dylan-ish thing in the vocals and the harmonica?
I mean, I wasn't into Bob Dylan so much when I was, like, a kid. It wasn't until I was, like, 23. In, like, the first time you go through, like, your first bad breakup or a girl, you know, you love that doesn't love you or whatever. And then you hear Blood on the Tracks from the same time.
Yeah.
Is when you can kind of, like, oh, it's more than just Mr. Tambourine Man.
Yeah.
And that's kind of when, for me, that I just kind of fell into the hole.
I also have read that you spent so much time making this record and that it was sort of a blessing and a curse. It was difficult for you. Talk about that.
Yeah, I think just one of those times where, like, I think anyone in their life has a moment of clarity, professional clarity or personal clarity, whatever. And finally, for the first time, it was like all I kind of had to do was make this album. And I was just thinking about inspiration and what's your purpose? What's anyone's purpose? What's my purpose? How can I connect with people, my friends or our audience in a bigger way, in a better way or something?
Because you had gotten attention and sold a lot of records and for this last record, so you felt like the bar was raised to do something more
The bar was raised. Yeah, exactly. And I never – with Slave Ambient, I felt very fortunate and humbled and the band got really good. But I didn't feel like I was really contributing to, I guess, songwriting in a way that I really wanted to.
Was there, when you were a kid, an aha moment when you said, yeah, if I can – whatever it takes, I want to make music for a living?
I never thought about a living part, but I definitely, the first time I ever played an electric guitar, I just remember, like, I was, like, hooked. But I didn't really think, honestly, I mean, it was like a
thing a kid did?
Right, or I didn't know. I mean, I wasn't really until, honestly, when we got a record contract with Secretly Canadian, it wasn't really until then that I actually had thought about doing it professionally. I mean, I was, like, in Philadelphia, and I was so into... I was like the extreme hobbyist, you know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
But I guess it didn't, I still felt so far from being competent even, you know? So like I'd recorded Arms Like Boulders and Taken the Farm and then they made their way to some people and they were like, you want to do a whole record? I was like, what do you mean? I don't know what you're talking about, you know? But it was kind of like, I guess I'd thought about wanting to find a way to do it all the time and like be more outward with it and play with people and that's kind of why I moved to Philly. But I didn't move there to like, start this band and hopefully get a deal. I was like just so obsessed with it for a period of time there. And then it slowly started to like reveal itself as like a possible career.
That seems like a good thing to have that kind of extreme amateur thing last as long as it can, actually.
Yeah, I mean, I feel blessed in the way that I didn't like actively ever like hunt down a recording contract like a lot of like people have for years and years, you know? And I always felt really blessed that the songs made their way to who they did, and having a home for your music has been what's forced me to like finish records and feel like I have to raise the bar and get better at
a home in
my
terms
craft.
Of a label.
Yeah, and get better at my craft and like, but I never, you know, I don't know. I feel very, you know, I think we all feel pretty fortunate that we can do this in the way that we do.
Well, will you play us one more The War on Drugs?
We will.
Song?
We're gonna play Lost in the Dream, the title track.
Terrific.
Thank you.
Of a moment, it's always hard to tell. Down in the way, they cut it open and they sold it. It's always hard to tell. Soldier man, and he licked his eyes and he wore them red. exist. You may risk it all, you'd risk it all for the memory. Now it's living under your skin. Love's the key to the things that you see, but you don't mind chasing. Leave the light on in the yard for me. Whoa.
The War on Drugs' new album, Lost in the Dream, is out right now. You can listen to full versions of all three live songs they perform for us in Studio 360 at studio360.org. And that's all for this hour of the show. Thank you very much for listening. For the full Studio 360 experience, though, be sure to check us out on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Studio 360 Show. My producers are little social media monsters. And do not forget to vote for us, Studio 360, in KPCC's Public Radio March Madness bracket. All the details are at studio360.org. Vote now. Vote often. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Jenny Lawton,
John Delore,
Sean Ramisferam,
Alana Harper,
Eric Malinsky,
Julia Lowry Henderson,
Rose Connolly,
Eliza Martin,
Andres O'Hara Plotnick.
Thanks as always to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tegen.
Studio 360 is supported in part by the SC Group, whose charitable resources include FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds at fjc.org, and by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, Art Works.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360's American Icon.
Ricky, can I be in the show?
The show that invented TV as we know it.
This stuff is in the DNA of every comedy writer.
I Love Lucy.
Lucy was always about desire. She wanted to do what she wanted to do. That's a seditious act.
That's next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.